In the last episode, we talked about keeping a changelog. Now, we're going to talk about how to keep a changelog with multiple contributors and not have a whole bunch of merge problems with this one file, the changelog. In this episode, I talk with Ned Batchelder about a tool called Scriv. And in the next episode, I'll talk with Hinnick about Town Crier. This episode is sponsored by Porkbun, a refreshingly different domain name registrar with over 500 domain extensions available. Porkbun offers everything from .com and .net to .app, .tech, and .dev. Every Porkbun domain comes with lots of freebies like SSL certificates, Whois privacy, URL forwarding, and hosting trials, all backed by 5-year support, 365 days a year. For tech folks, it gets even more exciting. They've even launched a new AI-generated search tool using ChatGPT that is leading the change in how people search for domain names. To celebrate the 5th anniversary of .app, Porkbun is offering a .app or .dev domain name for free to Test and Code listeners. To get your .app or .dev domain name for free, visit porkbun.com/testandcode or click the link in the show notes. Thank you, Porkbun, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to Test and Code. I've got a project that I've a couple projects that I'm having like growing pains with the release notes and I guess the changelog, really.
Yes.
And so I was looking into how to deal with it. There's like a whole bunch of ways to deal with it. Yeah, so here we are.
Here we are.
Well, so let's jump into Scriv. One of the options to deal with change logs is Scriv.
Yep.
And it's something you created.
Yep. By the way, you started by saying a tool to manage releases. This only does change logs and release notes. So for instance, it's not going to pick your next version number for you or update your version number, things like that. Some tools do that stuff. This, I did not take that on. Well, it's based on this idea that when you make a commit, when you, or let's say a pull request, you're going to change some aspect of your code, that is the moment when you should also write the changelog entry or the release note, however you want to look at it. They're the same thing as far as I'm concerned. But if you just have a big file at the root of your repo called, you know, changelog.md or something, then when you make your pull request and you put your changelog entry at the top of it, you're going to conflict with someone else who's also making a feature at the same time and putting their changelog entry at the top of changelog.md.
Yeah.
And those merge conflicts are a problem and a headache. So this tool works the way a number of other tools do, which is when you make your commit, you also write a small file that contains just the fragment of the changelog for the change you're making. And that fragment goes into a directory. And then later, and when it's merged, that file will get merged into the main branch. And when you make a release, you will look at all of those fragments in that directory and combine them to make the changelog that should go with that release.
Okay.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So I had experience with a large project with many developers years ago where we just had a big changelog file at the top of the repo. And they were always complaining about merge conflicts. And I changed the instructions to be, don't put your entry at the very top of the file. Just put it near the top of the file in the hope of avoiding merge conflicts. And the engineers would come to me and say, what do you mean near the top? Like the engineers couldn't deal with something as vague as near the top of the file. They wanted to know exactly where to put it. And so that didn't work.
Well, and I guess this might actually go towards like problems with merge tools.
It could. Although, I mean, to be fair to the merge tools, if you and I both put a paragraph in exactly the same point in the file, the merge tool is going to rightly say you both tried to change the same line in the file in different ways. Now, you could maybe have a merge tool that is clever. You know, you can direct it that for this file, you just want to take both changes. But there's other aspects, too. So, for instance, if I add a feature and then add a feature and then fix a problem and then deprecate something and then add a feature, I don't want them to appear in chronological order in my changelog. I want all of the added features at the top
Yeah.
And then I want the fixes, and then I want the deprecations, right? So there's a categorization of the entries that should happen that isn't based on strict chronology, and a merge tool is never going to get that right.
Okay. So the workflow is when I make a change, for some reason, so when do I add the little blurb, the little extra thing?
So it should go into your pull request. Let's say you're doing a pull request workflow, right? Where, so every change you make to the project is going to go into a pull request to be reviewed by someone. One of the files in your pull request would be the changelog fragment.
Okay.
In Scriv terms, you would use the scriv create command, and it would make a new fragment file in your changelog.d directory or whatever it's called. That file would be added as to your git commit, and it would be part of your commit. It would be part of your pull request. It would get reviewed as part of your pull request become part of the merge to main when the pull request was merged.
Okay. And so one of the other things I was looking at was Town Crier, and it does a similar thing, right?
Yep, it does. It's very similar.
Okay.
The big difference between Town Crier and Scriv is that Town Crier is extremely opinionated. It has a very quirky style of collecting the fragments. So, for instance, I think it is that the file extension of the text file indicates whether it's an add or a change or a fix, which just seems strange that the file extension should be what the format of the content is, not, you know, whether it's a fix or a change. Yeah, see, one of the things I was experimenting with Scriv was being extremely flexible and configurable. And there were two reasons for that. One, I started Scriv about 2.5 years ago when Black was in its ascendancy, and it was famous for having no options. It's extremely opinionated. And I thought, well, I'll try the opposite. Let's have all the options and no opinions. But the other thing is that I was hoping, and this hasn't worked out, I was hoping that Scriv would be adopted by my work project, which is a large open source project called OpenEdX. I was hoping that it would be adopted there and used for all of its repos. And I already knew that there were RST people and Markdown people and NPM versus Python and lots of repos there where there wasn't going to be a single culture that could use one quirky tool. It had to be a flexible, configurable tool. And so that's where I went with Scriv in terms of its design.
Okay. Well, that's cool. I'm happy about the Markdown bit.
Yep.
So how do I tell if it's not an extension part? How do I tell it if it's a bug fix or a feature or something?
That's a great question. So the structure of a fragment is that there is a header, which is got a category in it. So it's, you know, it says fixed, and then the underlines if you're in RST or a hash mark fixed if you're in Markdown.
Okay.
And then the content. And Scriv understands enough about the structure of both Markdown and RST that it can look at that fragment and see that it is a fix or an add. And then when it collects them together to create the changelog during a release, it will put the category pieces together and, you know, the same categories go together. And another advantage, by the way, of it being understanding the Markdown is that you can actually manage a changelog file. You might have a changelog.md. I could make a pull request and write a fragment.rst, and you could make a fragment.md. And then when we collect them, it'll actually get all transmogrified into Markdown because the changelog file is a Markdown. So it's trying to be very structured about the content in a way that lets it be a bit agnostic about what comes in, what goes out, those sorts of things.
So during a merge request, I do a Scriv. I already forgot it. Scriv create
a fragment.
Okay, and then these get populated in a changelog.d directory.
Then. Yep.
And then at some point, I've got a whole bunch of changes on main.
Yep.
And I say, let's do a release.
Right. And so part of your release process will be Scriv collect.
Okay.
Which will combine all the fragments. It'll delete the fragments from Git. It'll add the changes to the changelogs to Git. And now you've got a combined changelog file that could be checked in as part of your, you know, the final two or three commits of your release process.
Okay. And then the actual versioning, is it get involved with that at all or?
No. So Scriv doesn't have an opinions about the versions. It doesn't update your version number. It doesn't go and edit your, you know, dunder init.py or whatever where your version number is.
Okay.
It understands enough. You can tell it, you know, here is where you will find my version number so that you can include it in the header of the changelog.
Okay.
And there's a third command for Scriv called GitHub release. So I've always maintained my own changelog files. And then because I write Python code, I release them on PyPI. But GitHub has these releases, and people seem to want GitHub releases for some reason. I'm not sure why. It's exactly duplicative of information that's elsewhere.
Okay.
I don't know. Does anyone actually download like the .targz's or .zips from the GitHub release page in order to do a thing with software if they've got NPM or PyPI?
I don't know. You know,
real package management? I don't know. But anyway, people seem to want GitHub releases. And so Scriv GitHub release will read your changelog file, parse it, and create a GitHub release with the same information. So it's duplicated information, but at least it's automatically duplicated rather than having to edit a GitHub release in some way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so like one of the other ones that I've looked at is, what is it? The release drafter.
Okay.
Which is definitely part, it's like embedded in the GitHub world.
Yeah.
So. It doesn't even save a release. You can, but it doesn't save a changelog to your repo.
Right. I have opinions about that. GitHub is great, but all of the information about your project should be in files in your Git repo. The idea that you've got a changelog and it's not a file that I can read on disk when I clone your repo just seems really strange to me. That is incredibly important information about the history of your project. Why wouldn't you want it in a file in your project?
Yeah, it also allows you to grab main and none of the rest of the history if you just wanted to shallow clone and still get information about it. So.
Right, exactly. Right. I was taught long ago by a release manager from Debian that the source distribution of your project should be all of the files needed to create and continue to maintain that project in the event of a nuclear disaster. and nothing, if there's anything that you need that isn't in that source distribution, then you have left something behind that's important. And the idea that somehow GitHub releases is the source of truth for the history of your project just seems really strange to me. The other thing that seems really strange to me are these tools that make a changelog by just grabbing all the commit messages. Commit messages and changelogs are different things, and they've got different audiences, and you should write different information for different audiences.
Okay. That's an interesting take on that, so in order to get these commit messages to read well, you've got to like actually think about it when you're committing stuff. Then.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wait a second. Think about it. Yeah. No, I'm a huge fan of the idea that writing is a great way to explain things to people, but it's also a great way for you to understand what you are thinking about is to write about it. And I have often found, you know, I'll make a change the code. Yeah, change looks good. Okay, I guess I got to write a thing now about what I just did. And in the process of writing the changelog message or, you know, a detailed commit message, as some people do, I will realize something about what I've done. And maybe I'll, you know, tweak a name to be better, or I'll think of an edge case that I missed. And I'm just a huge fan of writing as a way of understanding for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely. But I want to just be realistic that there is some differences between a commit because I commit to my own branch because it's at the end of my day or something. Yeah. And I want, or it works now and I want to like have a starting point before I start changing some more stuff. And the mindset of a pull request where I think I'm ready to push this code into the rest of the code.
Absolutely.
So, They're different mindsets. So
no, I understand that. And I've got side projects where I don't keep release notes and I have very sketchy commit messages. but if you are supporting a project seriously and you have an audience that's trying to use your code, I really think it's worthwhile putting some time into writing changelog entries that are designed to be read by your users rather than, and also commit messages that are designed to be read by other developers on your project. And they are different people with different needs. That might be controversial. Developers don't want to write twice. Maybe it's the same text. Okay, copy and paste it. That's fine. One idea for a future feature of Scriv is to be able to pre-populate the changelog fragment with your commit messages. So at least if you've written a bunch of words that are useful, you'll have them as a starting point, even if I don't just literally make it the next changelog entry.
Okay.
It doesn't do that yet, but that would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you started by talking about this being not opinionated, like Black is opinionated, but
right.
Clearly there's some opinions, but...
Well, I personally have opinions about what is the value of writing.
Yeah.
But if you want Markdown, that's fine. If you want RST, that's fine. For instance, that Scriv does not have an opinion about what categories of changelog entries there are. There's a default of, you know, fixed, added, changed, deprecated, security, whatever. But you can make up your own categories and it'll be fine with them. How you want to structure your changelog. Is it a piece within your README already, or is it a separate file? You know, all of those questions are things that can be configured within Scriv.
Okay.
By the way, if someone out there wants to use Scriv and they cannot because there is some aspect of their workflow that it cannot do yet, get in touch. I'd be very interested to hear about what that is and to help it adapt.
The other question I have is, or actually I probably have more, but a question is mm-hmm. when, like at what point in a project should I use something like this rather than just handwriting a changelog?
Yeah, that's a good question. Definitely. So right now I use Scriv on itself and on another of my side projects, maybe two or three. And there it's a little strange because I'm a sole developer. So I could just edit the changelog.rst. In fact, for my primary side project, coverage.py, I do just edit literally a changes.rst file. And that's because that project predated by a decade's Scriv. So I haven't thought about yet whether I want to pull Scriv into that workflow. But if you have multiple developers, then this definitely helps avoid that traffic jam at the changelog file. For instance, CPython itself has a tool, not Towncrier, a different tool, I forget what it's called, but it has, again, the same idea. You make a news entry, they call it, in a directory, and then there's a process that aggregates them together for final publication. And it just keeps developers out from conflicting in that one file that they all have to edit all the time.
Yeah. So, and I'm trying to play with it. I'm considering starting using some sort of extra process just for even sole developer projects because mm-hmm. a workflow that I've often done for little projects is just, if I change anything, I'll do another release.
Right.
Because I might not actually work on this project for another month or two or something. So, and I'll forget what I did. So go ahead and release it. But sometimes there's like, it's silly. It's like, I put off things like formatting changes and different things because that's probably not going to go into a change log. But then I have to like hunt down what I did. So I'm actually thinking about trying to add something like this just for my own sanity's sake, just to keep track of things that I don't touch very often.
Right. And you know, it's the point you make is an interesting one. I've been trying to release more frequently. You almost came up with a philosophy, which is your changelog should only have one entry per release because every time you make a change, it should be a release. And in some ways, why not release that frequently? I don't know. I just haven't gotten quite into that mindset of releasing quite that often. But I'm getting there. I'm getting closer.
And I've heard other people say they will try to build up some stuff until like and just like I don't know. There's a regular cadence, like every couple of weeks, if they've been working on it, go ahead and release extra stuff. And definitely like if it's an active project, that makes sense. If you've got like multiple changes coming in a day, you don't want five releases a day. I mean, maybe you do. I don't know. It does seem a little confusing on the consumer side to have
yes.
a lot.
And one project, I haven't looked into it, but one project I have noticed because I use it on coverage.py is Hypothesis, which seems to go the multi-release per day route. And it is a little bit confusing. And for instance, at work, one of the things we have to do is keep our third-party dependencies up to date. And if a library is changing, like every time we run make update, that library comes in and we have to think about what changed on it. That's taxing on us.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure every change deserves a release, but I'm trying to be more frequent about it.
Okay. Well, on my list of people to talk to is somebody about Hypothesis. So, you know, maybe.
Is that Zach?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was at PyBay. So I was on a panel with him. Seems like a nice guy.
Yeah. But,
I'm like, what's up with the multi-releases per day thing? But so he's in the U.S. now. I thought he was in Australia for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny, but during the pandemic, I'm running Boston Python, and during the pandemic, we were all virtual, and so we had visitors from all over the world. And Zach dropped in on one of our events. That was cool.
Yeah. So I guess maybe I need to play with all of these to see what they feel like.
Okay.
And see what it feels like. Now this doesn't depend, like you said, it doesn't depend on GitHub. So I could use this for internal projects as well.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, the only connection, well, it connects to Git. It knows, so for instance, when you do a scriv create, it can do the Git add for you. And it will launch an editor the way Git does to edit the fragment. The GitHub release command, of course, is connected to GitHub. You know, in a lightweight way.
But if I had an internal, as long as it's Git, it should work.
Sure.
GitLab or something.
And the fact you don't even have to use the Git features, you could just use it to maintain files for you and do your own Git add or perforce add or whatever it is you'd need to do.
Okay. So, so we're talking about Scriv, but you're kind of a big deal, Ned.
Me?
Yeah.
No, that's too much pressure.
So what's going on in your life and your Python world and life and everything?
That's a big open-ended question.
Sorry.
That's okay. You know, I've got side projects going. One of my other side projects is a thing called Dingy, which was designed for me to keep up to date with activity on GitHub. I had to follow too many projects and watch projects and GitHub projects, that is, not open source projects. And so I wrote this thing called Dingy,
okay, which uses
the GitHub GraphQL API to do stuff. Keep mentioning it to people at work who complain they can't keep up with stuff. No one else has adopted it but me, but that's fine. It works well for me.
So is this an open source thing as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
See it. You've got Cog's been it goes in waves, I think, if people adopt Cog. So
yeah, Cog is the tool I wrote to inject little bits of computed content into plain text files, basically. And I continue to use it a lot. I just wrote some Cog fragments the other day. I got contacted by a Python core developer, I think just yesterday, about Cog. Because it's one of these things that grows really slowly over time. Like, it's not blowing up, and it's been around for 15 years or something, but
it's getting there. See what we can do about it.
No, it doesn't need, I think it was mentioned the other day, last year or something, as like it took 15 years to be an overnight success, you know, that kind of project.
Yeah. And supporting coverage, of course.
Supporting coverage, which is a big thing. 3.11, which is coming out in October, I guess within a few weeks. 3.11 made a number of large changes in the execution of Python in the pursuit of speed, which they've achieved. I think it goes about 25% faster than 3.10. But as a result, there was a bunch of upheaval with esoteric things like coverage that need to track execution. And that is now behind us. I guess until maybe 3.12 speed improvements come down the pike.
Okay.
But yeah, maintaining coverage is still a thing. I do a release maybe about once a month, once every 2 months, but they tend to be small fixes. The problem with coverage is that I get these bug reports about these crazy esoteric things like, oh, it doesn't work with TensorFlow. And I think, I can't even spell TensorFlow. I'm not going to be able to debug that. And I try to get attention from TensorFlow people, and they don't know what coverage is. And
Okay. Yeah. So I guess very popular projects, Double-Edged Sword, I guess, for you. You're not the sole maintainer of coverage, are you? Or are you just?
I am. Yeah, basically I am. I get pull requests from people and a lot of help in that way, but there is not another person who can review the code for me or with me.
Okay.
Or knows how to release it or anything like that. So yeah, okay. I'm the sole maintainer.
I guess thanks then, because sure. We all love coverage. Well, cool. You're involved with the Boston, a little bit involved with the Boston meetup, right?
Yeah. So I used to be the main guy who did everything for the Boston Python meetup. But I've been really lucky in having other people show up and say they want to do things and then they do them.
Nice.
Yeah. So for instance, Brian, your book about your second edition of the PyTest book is now a book club that's being run by one of our newest organizer, who I've never met because he joined the group during the pandemic, and he said he wanted to do a book club. And I said, that sounds hard. I don't know how it's going to work, but he said, I'm going to do it, and he's doing it, and it's great. And
oh, awesome.
Yeah.
And is it still virtual then?
We haven't yet gotten back to physical in-person meetups, partly just because everyone's still a little skittish, but also because even in before times, it was hard for us to find hosts that could host us because we would tend to get 80 to 100 people.
Yeah.
And so now we have to find hosts that are both large enough and don't mind the risk of hosting in-person events. And right now we're entering back into the cold season, which tends to give a little bump to things, but everyone's vaccinated, so maybe it won't be a problem. So I don't know. Something will probably happen pretty soon.
But I mean, there's definitely need for that, for people to actually get together and see each other in person, especially if they don't have colleagues that they interact with much.
I know. I have a feeling the first back to person in person event we do, everyone's going to be one, really excited, and two, will think we really should have done this a year ago.
Okay,
that'd be my guess.
But there's probably a non-zero portion of the population that really wants them to stay remote so that they can without commuting.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Glenn, who is running your book club, the book club for your book, I should say, lives, I don't know, an hour or two north of Boston.
Yeah.
And so feels an affinity to a Boston meetup, but probably wouldn't attend in person. It would be difficult for him. And we're doing weekly office hours now, and one of our regular attendees of the office hour, I think, lives in Mexico.
Nice.
And, you know, why not, right?
Why not? So, yeah.
So, I mean, during the pandemic, I was wondering, what does the word Boston mean in Boston Python meetup anymore? But I don't know. You're not going to have a worldwide meetup.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you got to at least pick a time zone.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to at least pick a time zone. That's right.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for your time today, and thanks for describing this to me.
Scrib is another of these projects that started very slowly. In fact, I was kind of astonished to realize, as I was going back through the history, that I started this 2.5 years ago. And right now, as far as I know, it's only being used by three of my side projects, but I think other people are using it because I'm getting feedback, but it has not hit the big time yet. Maybe it never will. That's fine. It's been fun to work on.
Well, I have a couple of stupid things that I kick around that are useful for myself. But then sometimes some of them start getting used by other people. And then I start kind of caring about not being a dork and just changing things willy-nilly.
Yeah, it's tricky. So.
But at the same time, I still want I think I should have the freedom to do that. I mean, it's my project, right? But at the same time, yeah.
I think when it comes to that, I think the important thing is to be clear about it. Like, you could put into the top of your README, feel free to use this, but I don't care. I'm going to do what I want to do.
May change at any moment.
Yeah. So. Or like I could have put at the top of Scriv, I'm using this now. I don't know if anyone else is. If you are, please let me know so that I can start to wonder whether I need to be careful with it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to get these very formulaic READMEs that try to present everything as if they're, you know, the next thing that's going to change the world. But like you said, like, we're just one dude sitting in our room hacking on some code because it was interesting for a little while. Why can't we be transparent about that in our READMEs?
And okay, so your code doesn't enforce any versioning or anything.
Portion. Scriv doesn't. No.
Okay. No. Are you a semantic version kind of person, or do you?
I am. Yeah. Okay. I try to be. I mean, it's a little tricky because semantic versioning is based on the idea that there is a well-defined interface, and you need to know whether you have changed it or not, and often that is very difficult to determine.
Well, with Python, you can reach into anything, so the entire code base is an interface.
Well, yes. Well, there's that. For instance, I mean, I've had that problem with coverage.py, and I try to be strict about it. Like, I documented a bunch of stuff. I'm making promises about that stuff. And if it's not documented, you're on your own. I'm not going to bend over backwards to deal with that. But, you know, things like, I mean, here's the example I've used before, Pylint, right, which issues violations for your code. If the set of violations changes, is that a breaking change for Pylint? Because their interface is, we read your code and out comes a set of violations. I don't know that anyone would think it is, but in a way, that's their interface. So,
and like if they add a new one.
If they add a new one, or if something tweaks and so they set the times it appears changes.
Yeah.
Is that an interface? I don't know.
Well, there's so many of these corner cases with semantic versioning. So I've talked to somebody about the Calver.
Before. Yep.
Interesting. Just bump like the other digits are the same, but the top one, you bump it every year.
Well, and that's what PIP does, right? PIP is Calver, yeah. Calendar versioning.
Yeah. So, and I was thinking like to force people to read the changelog. Just do randver, just a random number generator.
Randver, okay.
The picks your version for you.
But is it at least going to be monotonically increasing, or are you going to have three after version four?
Sure, it can just be any version. It just okay. So you have to pin it. It can't be a less than or equal or anything like that.
That would be mean. I mean, you would get some hate mail, I think, if you really did that. But. You guarantee you not to have any users of your tool.
Okay, well, the real randver probably isn't a random number generator, but just it looks like semantic versioning, and they keep growing further, but you don't know if it's going to break between major versions or not.
Yes. Well, remember Donald Knuth, when he produced his text formatting system, used versions where the version number was pi, and he would add a new digit to the end of pi.
I don't know that.
Yes, yeah, so great. And that was because he really had this feeling like I am asymptotically approaching this thing being literally done. Like, it's not just going to grow forever. It is nearing perfection. So we'll just add one more. And URLib3, I think, did the same thing, right? 0.9999999 was a version of theirs. So there's plenty of innovation to be had in the versioning game.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, I could probably BS with you a whole bunch, and if I wanted to, I probably should show up at the Buy Stuff Boston meetups more. So,
well, yeah, sure,
cool. Well, thanks for your time, and catch up with you later.
Okay,
bye.
All right, bye.
Thanks, Ned, for maintaining some awesome tools for the Python community and for talking with me about them. Listen to episode 200 if you'd like to find more about keeping a changelog. And stick around for the next episode, episode 202, where we'll discuss a similar tool called Town Crier. Thank you, Patreon supporters, for your awesome continued support for the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And please subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend. To find out when episodes are released, head to testandcode.com/subscribe. There you'll find the feed that you can add to your podcast player so you can get all the new episodes and an email notifier that you can sign up for if you want to get emailed when a new episode comes out. And also a link to Patreon. So not only Patreon supporters get announcements for when the episodes come out, but they also help keep the show going. You can also follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at Brian Aachen at fostodon.org. I'll also announce new episodes there. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.